This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Last week, last Friday, on this program, in the context of the whole, the whole Reverend Wright and Barack Obama thing was kind of unraveling at that point, and I think we'll get into a conversation about Barack Obama's news conference yesterday in a little bit. I think he has closed that door, although time will tell. But nonetheless, we had a very poignant call on this program. A fellow by the name of Ernest from Los Angeles called in and basically said, you know, what are you white people afraid of? And in fact, here is his call.
What have we as black people ever did to quote-unquote America? We never went to war against you. We never killed anybody. We never did anything. So what is it? What is it? I mean, Germans, we went to Germany, Germans killed us, Japanese killed us, as Americans. What have black people did to deserve what we go through? And everybody keeps saying, well, it's not there, it's not there. It's like we did something to white, quote unquote, white America. I don't like even use that word because I consider myself as American. But what have we done that we cannot get from under this yoke that you have put on us 400 years ago? And half of the black people are still angry. What have we done to you?
Damn good question, Ernest. And that's what I was. I know I could provide all the rationalizations about, you know, Nixon's Southern strategy and, you know, corporate policies stripping people of their jobs and let's play the blacks off it and say, oh, you know, it's affirmative action. They want your job. So I said, you know, let's get somebody on who really is in the middle of this. You know, one of the white guys who's very concerned about the black guys. And we have with us now Pastor Thomas Robb. He is the national director of the Knights Party, otherwise known as the Ku Klux Klan. The website is kkk.bz. And as in business, kkk.bz. First of all, Pastor Robb, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm assuming you heard that question, and I'm curious. You know, what are you afraid of?
Well, first off, he makes a comment. He says that, you know, what have we ever done for you?
No, he said
done to you.
I can tell you what they've done for us. They provided us with hundreds of years of free labor.
Uh-huh. Well, they're providing free labor for me. And I doubt they provide any free labor for you.
Well, to the extent that this country was built on slave labor, I think they provided a lot of free labor to both of us.
I don't know. We
wouldn't have had the American Revolution. We wouldn't have had the affluence for it were it not for slave labor.
I'm not sure that it was built on slave labor. Slave labor was only in the southern states. The northern states abolished slave labor years before, and the industry of America was in the north primarily. So, you know, I would not say it was built on slave labor either.
So, well, to that point, just this may be putting a fine point on it, but there was a variation on slave labor practiced in the North that was not a racist version. Yeah, there were a lot of Europeans who were coming over as indentured servants with 5, 10, 20-year indentures.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, so there was a form of slave labor in the North as well. It just wasn't a racist form. Arguably it was, because it was mostly Irish, you know, and the British at that time were doing a pretty good job of oppressing the Irish. But, you know, the bottom line here, as, you know, your website talks about, you know, bringing a message of hope and deliverance to white Christian America. What are you afraid of with regard to, for example, an African-American becoming president or just the African-American community in general?
Well, first off, we're afraid of facts being stated, like you stated about them building America. So that's an untruth. And to state an untruth like that as if it's a fact, that's number one thing.
Okay.
We have to look at. As far as slave labor in the South, there were many blacks who owned slaves also in the South. It was not exclusively white slavery ownership of blacks. There were blacks who owned slaves. In fact, the very first slave owner in America was in Virginia. He was actually a black man. You know, as far as...
I think you're citing the exceptions that prove the rule, sir.
The concept of America, when you look at America, the concept of America, of free enterprise, the concept of self-government, the concept of innocent until proven guilty, our whole constitutional republic, came out of our people. It was built by Europeans. Blacks did not build America. They were not the architects of America any more than somebody who constructs a beautiful building.
Well, they were in slavery at the time. I would say they were building America, but they were not certainly at the Constitutional Convention, if that's what you mean to say.
They
would have been prevented from walking into the building.
They were never at any Constitutional Convention, any country.
Right. There were, however, Native Americans there.
Africa today still does not have, constitutional conventions that you mentioned before. So they were never at any constitutional convention in which self-government was the result.
Well, it's only been since the 1950s that most of the colonial powers have left Africa.
And where is Africa today? Rhodesia was a prosperous country, exported mass quantities of grain and wheat out of Rhodesia after Mugabe took over 28 years ago. Today, Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe,
right,
cannot even produce enough food for its own citizens.
And I would submit to you that this is the predictable consequence of ruling a nation as a colonial power, stripping them of their culture, denying to them the knowledge of how these things, how the technology that you're bringing in works, and then just creating this enormous vacuum. I mean, I was in Uganda in 1980 and 81 during the war against Idi Amin, and I can tell you, that was that power vacuum that allowed Idi Amin to come into power was a direct result. I mean, it was a few years later, but it was a direct result of 1956 when Churchill just said, okay, I've had enough criticism, I'm walking away, and there was no Marshall Plan to rebuild Africa the way we did with Europe. There was nothing. It was just, okay, we're out of here.
Yeah, well, you can say that's what you would submit, and everybody who listened to you, maybe not everybody, but a great number of people who listen to that comment would laugh at it.
But I've been there. I've been in Kenya. I've been in Uganda. I've been in the Sudan. I was in Darfur just 5 weeks ago.
So I'm telling you, what you're seeing are the echoes of
colonialism.
You're saying they're unable to build a country after close to 60 years now since whites left Africa?
Whites came to this continent in the 1600s, and it was...
You mentioned Africa.
And it was 200 years later before we had any kind of industrial base here. You're saying that they should...
We had a very prosperous economy, however, and so to say that we were not backwards, we had a prosperous economy, we had civility in the streets, people were not starving.
So let's get this back to Barack Obama and his. I mean, we can argue Africa all day long, and it'll be a kind of he said, she said, sir. And I think it's more important for us both to have a conversation about why the KKK and you as the national director of the Knights Party, KKK.BZ, why you are concerned. I mean, on your website it says, I think the phrase was, it goes without saying that we're not endorsing Barack Obama. What concern do you have about an African-American as president? He seems like a smart, articulate...
Do you have any concern about his association with Bill Ayers?
I'm sorry?
Do you have any concern about his association with Bill Ayers?
No, none whatsoever. His association, they sat on a board together. Do you have any concern about Hillary Clinton being on the board with guys who are... I certainly do. Do you have any concern about John McCain having, more lobbyists on...
Absolutely. Okay. I would not endorse John McCain for president either. None of the candidates I feel are friends of the American.
But the bottom line is it not that your concern about Barack Obama is a concern about race?
Well, I think actually Barack Obama probably would help galvanize white people nationwide, where whatever John McCain would do would be rubber stamped by the Republican Party, and probably could do a lot more harm to us than Barack Obama could do, because I think the Republican Party would probably be not likely to endorse his program.
Sir, we have about a half a minute left. What, in your opinion, would be the negative consequence of Barack Obama being president? What are you afraid of?
Well, I think that the same thing I mentioned before, whether it be Barack Obama or John McCain or Hillary Clinton, any one of those people would be somebody who I think would not be a friend of America. Mm. They are engaged in a globalist policy. They're light on our immigration laws. They our open borders with Mexico seems to not be a great concern. Maybe they speak somewhat of it now as we approach the election time. But certainly was not of a great concern over the years previously.
Okay. Very, very quick question my agent wanted me to ask you. Do you guys use liquid fabric softener or the sheets for your sheets?
Do we do what?
I'm sorry. It was a bad joke. But Pastor Thomas Robb, National Director of the Knights Party, the Ku Klux Klan, KKK.BZ. Sir, I appreciate your coming on and having a conversation with us. Thank you.
I appreciate it all.
Tom Hartman, speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Twenty-one minutes past the hour. Well, that was interesting. It was interesting that he was not quite as explicit as his website at KKK.BZ. On the other hand, I was surprised. You know, I half expected when I said, "What are you afraid of?" that he would say, "I'm not afraid of anything," and instead he had a list of things that he was concerned about, that he was afraid of. I just want to share with you what I think is the bigger picture here, and how I learned about this. First of all, the conclusion. The bigger picture is there is no such thing as race. Now, I realize that sounds like, you know, how can you say that? Scientifically speaking, genetically speaking, there is no gene for race. There is no single gene that makes a person black or white. Or actually, there are genes that affect skin color, but there is no single gene that makes a person what we would call a Caucasian, or what we would call Mongoloid or Negroid, or all the various words that have been used over the, I don't know what the old pseudoscientific word was for Native Americans, Asian and what's not. What we have, and the way that I learned this, by the way, what we have are a whole variety of hundreds of different genes that combine and cross combine, and as people intermarry and interrelate, change and move around. We have a whole bunch of different genes that all do different things, none of which are specific to, quote, race. And the way I learned about this was back in 78, I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility for severely abused kids in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Village. It's still there, along with the Hunter School, which we started for ADHD kids. HunterSchool.org is the website. You can Google New England Salem Children's Village. I think it's just SalemChildren'sVillage.org is the website. And as the executive director of that program, I noticed an enormous number of kids coming into the program with what was then called the hyperactive syndrome, hyperactivity, hyperkinesis. And I wrote, in fact, one of the first papers on this topic in 1981. It was published in the Journal of Orthomolecular Psychiatry. About, you know, thoughts on the hyperactive syndrome. I had met with Dr. Ben Feingold out in San Francisco. We did a double-blind study of his diet with our kids, with 34 kids, and it was the result of that study. And over the years, as a consequence of that and experiences within my own family, over the years I've written 7 books on attention deficit disorder, and I hypothesized back in my first book, which was published in 1991, called ADD, A Different Perception, the Hunter and a Farmer's World book, I hypothesized that the genes that coded for the behavior of distractibility, impulsivity, and a high need for levels of arousal and sensation-seeking, risk-taking, that those three things, which are the three-legged stool upon which a diagnosis of ADHD rests, would actually be adaptive in a hunting-gathering society. They'd be highly useful in a hunting-gathering society. You'd be noticing everything around you. We call that distractibility now. If you're out in the jungle or the field or the savannah, that would be useful. It would save your life. You make quick decisions. We call that impulsivity now in a classroom. But if you were out there in the forest hunting and a rabbit, you were chasing a rabbit and a deer went by, you don't have time to sit down and do a risk-benefit analysis. You have to make instant decisions. So it would be highly adaptive. And the need for high levels of stimulation. The person who wakes up in the morning and says, "I'm not going to go out there. There's lions and tigers and bears out there." That person would starve in that world. So I suggested that ADHD was A, genetic, and B, was adaptive. It was a good thing in some environments. 15 years later, almost 20 years later, however long it's been, 92 until 2 years ago, the research came in. the genetic research actually has now been done. And what they found was that the DR gene, the dopamine receptor genes, the DR genes, DR2, DR4, the dopamine transporter genes, the DT genes, they looked at the 7th and 11th alleles, these pieces of these genes, and they found that, yes, in fact, among people with ADHD, quote, these genes code for lower levels of dopamine, and among people with obsessive compulsive disorder or something short of that, people who just would make very good bookkeepers, very quiet, methodical, not risk takers, you have very high levels of dopamine. And in other words, there's this genetic difference. It's regardless of race. The genes that encode for intelligence have nothing to do with the genes that encode for skin color. The genes that encode for skin color have nothing to do with the genes that encode for ADHD. The genes that, I mean, it's just that sometimes there are similarities and associations, skin color and eye color, for example, or some types of facial features. But by and large, race is an artifice. Race is, it's something that you see on the outside. But it is not, and this is where I think Barack Obama found Pastor Wright's comments so offensive. Because Pastor Wright was basically saying, hey, there's black people and they're different than white people. Well, there may be cultures that are different, but when you get right down to the, or subcultures rather that are different, but when you get right down to the bottom of it all, we are all just human beings. There's this vast variety of humanness to us, but we're all just human beings. And that was Obama's message, and I think that that was why he was so offended by Reverend Wright. And for me, that's the carry-home message, that we're all just human beings here. We now know, as just in the last 15 years, we now know through genetics that there is no single gene for race. There is not even a good collection of genes for race. It's highly variable. And all of these generalizations that have been made over the years are terrible, terrible things that have done a disservice to us as the human race. It really is time for us all to consider the human race and pull together and just start saying, you know, we're past that whole thing about skin color or how somebody's hair is. I mean, that's got nothing to do with anything. What's the character of a person's soul?
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman, Rachel Maddow, Lionel, and more. Download all of your favorite shows with Air America On Demand. Only on AirAmerica.com.
Four minutes past the hour. Well, as we like to say here, from the wire services today, in an act that campaign insiders said indicated an irrevocable break with his former pastor, Senator Barack Obama today defriended the Reverend Jeremiah Wright on Facebook. Senator Obama's comments about Reverend Wright on Tuesday seemed to indicate that a total rift with his former minister was underway, but his decision to defriend Reverend Wright on Facebook underscores the seriousness of his decision. At a press conference in Gary, Indiana, Chief Obama strategist David Axelrod said that Senator Obama had to defriend the Reverend Wright on Facebook, quote, because he was getting really annoying. Every day, Reverend Wright was sending Senator Obama new Facebook applications like, what superhero are you? And what 1980s toy are you? Mr. Axelrod said, after a while, enough is enough. Reverend Wright, who was the commencement speaker today at Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Clown College in Sarasota, Florida, made no references to Senator Obama, instead saying that the United States government, quote, is plotting to invade the moon, end quote. On CNN, Democratic National Committee Chair Howard Dean expressed fears that if the primary campaign drags on much longer, quote, there may not be enough room under the bus for the candidates to throw their aides. With Senator Obama having thrown Reverend Wright and Samantha Power under the bus, and Senator Clinton having thrown Geraldine Ferraro, Patty Solis Doyle, and Mark Penn under the bus, Mr. Dean said, we may need an additional bus. Now, thanks to Andy Borowitz for his ever-prescient take on the news. No, it's not the news. It's Andy Borowitz. BorowitzReport.com, by the way. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tupac. Listening on KPHX in Phoenix. Hey, Tupac, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Thanks again for taking my call.
Sure.
I thought that was a really good segment, that last piece that you did on humanity and our identity. And in reality, you know, humanity has as a nationality global the planet, of course, you know, Mother Earth. That's a traditional indigenous cultural teaching, but it's also a science.
Yeah.
And I think in the dialogue, you know, that we're having here recently, well, not recently, but that's been highlighted recently by the Obama campaign and the recent issues, the term white person and the term white goes spoken as part of the vernacular without being questioned as how that usage is reinforcing the very racism that we're criticizing at every turn, and which is actually not part of the American dream.
Right.
And I would say
which also, if I may interrupt you, gets into Malcolm X's book, where he commented about how white is parallel, is a synonym in the English language for good and pure, and black is a synonym for evil, dark is a synonym for evil, and you know, how can that help but affect the way that we perceive people's color and race? I mean, we have problems even within our own language.
Exactly. Yeah, the aspect of the language is what should be also analyzing the campaigns. But I think part of the campaign is to transition the concept of the American dream from just a middle-class economic status to societies or communities living in ecological equilibrium.
Yes.
On the planet. And
yes.
That is the dream.
If we don't do that, we're all screwed.
Pardon me?
If we don't do that, we're all screwed.
Exactly.
I mean, and this is what we have to learn from indigenous and aboriginal people, is how to live in balance, where everything's waste is something else's food, where it's all a giant cycle, where we can live in harmony and balance. And frankly, we have to start living in harmony and balance with each other and with the world around us. Tupac, you always have great insights. Thanks so much for the call. I really appreciate it. And Chris in Ithaca, New York, listening to WNYY. Hey, Chris, what's up? Hey, Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Your show.
Thank you.
I want to comment on what you said about there only being one race and that being human. The misuse of race as we currently know it, black, white, Asian, whatever, is going to continue as long as we, the people, allow it to continue.
Yep.
And I've got a suggestion as to how we can start the stopping of that.
Okay.
If you and your listeners would check the other box every time they're given a form that asks their race.
Are you talking about the U.S. Census kind of thing or insurance forms?
Any government form that asks your race, check other.
Yeah.
And if you're allowed to write in something out to the side of that, write in human.
That's a great one. Eventually they're going to be scratching their head going, oh, yeah.
Yeah, and all of their demographics will go to hell, and they'll quit using it.
Yeah. Now, there are some differences that have to do with, and thanks, Chris, thanks for the point. There are some differences, and I know somebody will call and just, you know, to essentially kind of rebut this. There are some differences that have to do with where your ancestors grew up. For example, the obvious one that most people know about is sickle cell anemia. Sickle cell anemia is where the red blood cells, instead of being round when they're stressed out, become shaped like a sickle moon, like a third of a moon. And sickle cell anemia makes it harder for the plasmodium parasite, the malaria parasite, to live inside red blood cells. And so it confers a certain degree of immunity to malaria. Not immunity, but it makes it so it's not as severe. And you see this among people who grew up in Africa. But that doesn't mean that it's associated necessarily with race. For example, I have celiac disease. Celiac disease is a genetic condition where you can't digest gluten. It 1 in 15 people born in Northern Europe, and both of my father's parents came from Norway. They were Norwegian immigrants in 1917. 1 in 15 people coming from Northern Europe are born with the gene for celiac disease. That is, they can't digest wheat or gluten. Keith Olbermann, in fact, shares this with me. 1 out of 5,000 people from Italy shares that gene, because in the southern part of Italy, for thousands of years, they've been eating wheat, whereas the Norwegians were only conquered 800 years ago by the Christians, and only 500-600 years ago really started eating a wheat-based diet. It's a very rare thing. So in Scandinavia, they test every baby for this. It doesn't have anything to do with race. It has to do with the environment in which your ancestors grew up. We have to understand this stuff. It's far more complex than, oh, he's a black person, he's a white person. What does that mean? It means nothing. George in Phoenix, Arizona, KPHX. Hey, George.
Hey, Tom. Great conversation, necessary conversation. When you started talking about genetics, though, something dawned on me. this is why we're seeing the right attacking the idea of Darwin and genetics, because they don't want a scientific means of showing them that they're like everybody else.
Right. Well, I mean, you had the Mormon Church up until just within Mitt Romney's lifetime. I think it was in the mid-70s or the mid-80s. For over 100 years, you had the Mormon Church suggesting that the mark of Cain, you know, Cain killed Abel and God put a mark on his forehead and sent him off so that wherever anybody saw him, he could be persecuted.
Yes.
And the Mormon Church said that's blackness.
Yep.
And therefore you couldn't be a good Mormon and be black. And you know, they changed with the times, as it were, and said, oh, well, you know, apparently Joseph Smith was wrong and the tablets of Moroni were wrong, which kind of brings into question a whole lot of things. But nonetheless, yeah, I think your point is well taken, George. We really do need to look at this in a more practical fashion, I think. Nanette in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Nanette.
Hi, how you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Me too. You know, I just called in. I'm African American, and it's just, you know, I find this whole issue of race just really kind of ironic. I mean, when you think about it, race is in this country especially, is far more social construct.
Yep.
Than it is an ethnic identity. I mean, the vast majority of black people in this country have white blood.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's true.
So, and also in converse, if you look at white people that whose heritage comes from the South, at least 10% of them have black blood.
Right.
Including maybe the Ku Klux Klan guy that you spoke to.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, my mother's family's been in this country since the 1600s. You know, the odds are very high that there are African Americans in my lineage, and I know that there are Native Americans in my lineage. We're all mongrels here. We're all
exactly.
Human beings here.
Exactly.
Now the other point, though, that I think that we have to acknowledge is that because race has been used as more than just a social construct for so many years, that subcultures have evolved over time as a way of collectively defending against the use of race against people. And now you've got this, you know, this kind of backlash, which the KKK certainly represents.
Mm-hmm.
And it's being manipulated, in my opinion, by the corporatists. It's being manipulated by people who will say, oh, yeah, we're going to send your job off to China. Well, actually, we're not going to talk about sending your job to China. What we're going to say is, it's those quotas, you know.
Well, you know, and that's been going on since, you know, since America's been America. When you think about it,
yep.
You know, a lot of people don't want to talk about the fact that, you know, you talk about the Trail of Tears and the five civilized
yep.
American Indian tribes.
Yep.
They had slaves. And one of the reasons they were given slaves was to separate them and to make them feel as though they were superior to the black folks that were surrounding them. And so this has been, you know, this whole social, this whole way of getting the rich to make people that don't have as much money, that are not as powerful, you know, give them a little bone.
Yeah.
Give them a little bone.
I thought it was interesting. You know, Peter Farb wrote Man's Rise to Civilization, which is the best ethnography, in my opinion, of first contact with Native American tribes all across the United States. And he chronicles hundreds of different tribal communities and how they organize socially. And he only found a couple, and most of them were in the Pacific Northwest, where the salmon runs came twice a year, and so it was possible for a small aristocracy to lock up the food. He only found a couple Native American cultures that actually practiced slavery. The vast majority of them didn't. It was alien to them and totally
exactly.
foreign to their way of thinking. And the same is true of Africans at first contact.
Yeah,
and so this is something that is just, you know, it's sick and twisted, and it's damaged our country beyond belief, and it's time for a healing and a reconciliation. Nanette, thank you so much for your thoughtful comments.
Sure thing.
Much appreciated. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, our website, airamerica.com as well. We'll be right back.
Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice.
Yeah, give me a flashback here, Grace. And why was it a white rabbit? Is that some sort of a racial comment? No, I think, you know, this is just culture and history. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Shion, if I'm pronouncing that right, in Miami, Florida, listening on WINS.
Hello.
Hi, is it Shion?
Hi, this is Shion, yes.
Welcome, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment, and this racial thing is going on and on and on. 45 years ago, I was the first black woman that went to work for any airline in California.
Hmm.
At 70, I'm hearing the same thing I heard 50 years ago.
Yeah.
The thing is that when the slaves were brought here, the people that were here, the European Americans, they gave them everything they had. They brought nothing from Africa except their little seeds in their pockets and their fear. This country gave them their name.
Respectfully, Shion, they brought a rich culture with them.
And they
brought language with them, and they brought religion with them, and those things were systematically stripped from them.
Exactly. And in that place, they gave them a quasi-religion, a quasi-name, a.k.a. roots. They gave them everything.
Right.
Now, this is a mixture of what they gave them and what they could retain.
Right.
So when white people say they don't know anything about black people, I don't think that's true, because black people worked in their kitchens, in their field, been in their lives for, what, the past 200 years?
Mm-hmm.
So if they don't know anything about them, then we have a generational gap of the people that are in their 40s and 50s now that don't know their history. White people don't know their history. Black people don't know their history, because nobody reads in this country. They take the propaganda and hearsay.
Yeah.
If black people read European history, they would never stop twice if someone calls them whatever name they call them. My feeling is this is my piece of dirt, too.
Yeah.
I don't back down to anybody.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody is superior to me. White people aren't superior. We are not superior. We are not inferior. But we do need to know our history.
Shion, you raise a really important point, and thank you so very much for calling and saying it. And if I can riff on this just for a moment, there's this thing called the Harvest Gathering that's put together by a magazine in the Northwest, and the folks who put it on every year this was in 96, I think, 95, 96, something like that. They invited people from different races and religions, and here we are using that construct, different parts of the world, in fact. There was literally elders from Africa who were invited. There were Native Americans who were invited. There were elders from Aboriginal tribes in South America. In fact, one fellow came from Peru and brought some coca leaf with him. It was a remarkable time, and I was the guy who they selected to be the elder for the white group, right, the white Americans. And so there's about a dozen of us who are sitting in this group, and there's maybe 400 or 500 people around us, and there's a bunch of young people, young white middle-class people who are dressed like Native Americans. They're dressed in buckskin and stuff for this harvest gathering in western Massachusetts, this fall celebration. And Frank Nosey, who's this Native American, he has since deceased. No, his last name wasn't Nosey. I'm sorry, I don't remember his last name. But Frank leaned over to me, and I wrote about it. You can find this on my website. I wrote an article about it. Frank leaned over to me, and he said, "Why are those white kids out there dressing like Native Americans?" He says, "Why do you guys want to imitate us?" He said, "We have been slapped around. We have been spat upon. We've had our land stolen. We've had our women raped. We've had our men murdered. We've had, you know, you don't, I don't understand it. I don't get it. Why would anybody want to be with us, like us?" He said, and I said, "Frank, you remember your ancient language?" And he said, "Yes, I can still speak the language of my people." I said, "You remember the sacred places?" He said, "Yes, I do." I said, "You remember the sacred traditions, or at least many of them, the plants, the names of the gods, the directions, the sacred directions, things like that, the rituals?" He said, "Yes, I do." I said, when my parents came from Europe, my mother and my father, their parents came from Europe, I said, I went back to Norway where my father is from, and in one of my great-grandparents' home, in the back of that house, there is a stone on which there is writing that is about 2,000 years old, and nobody today can tell me what that writing says. There was a time when my ancestors lived tribally, just like yours did, Frank. And then the Celts first 3,000 years ago, then the Romans 2,000 years ago swept across Europe, and then the Catholic Church 1,000 years ago swept across Europe, and they stripped from all of the European tribal people. And Jefferson wrote about this extensively when he talked about the Whig histories. They stripped, and the Anglo-Saxons, in fact, the Electoral College was based on the pre-Roman, the Wicca Gemeimot, the Council of Wise Elders from the tribal times in England. They stripped from the tribal Europeans their culture and their history. I said, my people have lost connection with their ancient roots. Your people have not. And I think that that's one of the reasons why young white people find so attractive the traditions of Native Americans. And he said, my God, I never understood. He said, your people are like hungry ghosts. Spiritually, you're empty. And I said, yeah. Yeah, we've lost that connection. And what's been replaced with it? Stuff. Toys. Consumerism. Sexuality. You know, short-term pleasures. Money. And it's really no replacement for deep culture. And this is the same thing that happened to African Americans when they were brought to North America from Africa. They were stripped of their cultural roots, of their cultural heritage. And I think that, frankly, all of us need to be going back and saying, what are the ways that worked 5,000 years ago? What were the ways that humans were actually able to live in stasis, in homeostasis, in balance with the environment and with each other? What are the lessons that the Iroquois taught the founders?
Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Lots of discussion in our chat room about my comments, about my conversation at the Harvest Gathering with Frank, the Native American elder. And Louise just put a link to the article that I wrote back at the time, this was a decade ago, on our homepage at tomhartman.com if you want to read that. It was sponsored by Spirit of Change magazine, which is published in Western Massachusetts by Carol Bedrosian, an old and dear friend, and her partner, Little Bear. Marvelous people. So, anyhow, that's kind of wrapping up our last hour. With us right now is Professor Marjorie Cohn. She's the president of the National Lawyers Guild and a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Her website, Marjorie, M-A-R-J-O-R-I-E, Cohn, C-O-H-N, .com. And Professor Cohn, Marjorie Cohn, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Tom.
I asked you to come on the program today because there was a fascinating piece that Sheldon Rampton wrote. I saw it over at Common Dreams. It was published by the Center for Media and Democracy. It's still there. The headline at commondreams.org is Pentagon Pundit Scandal Broke the Law. And as you know, the New York Times basically outed this thing that's been going on for apparently since the beginning of the Bush administration, where the Pentagon was spiffing in a variety of ways, not financial necessarily, but giving special access, special briefings, inside information to a lot of ex-military and current military who then were encouraged to go out into our media and spread propaganda and disinformation. And there is a piece of legislation that every year since 1951 has been attached to every single appropriation bill. And this goes back to the there are communists in the State Department stuff, you know, the Joe McCarthy time, that says that no part of any appropriation contained in this or any other act shall be used for publicity or propaganda purposes within the United States, not heretofore authorized by Congress. This is the law in the United States. And it seems to me quite clear, and Sheldon Rampton built a very strong case for this, that this law was broken by this administration and by this Department of Defense. However, it also appears that our Justice Department, this unitary executive, is absolutely unwilling to enforce the law. What are our constitutional and judicial remedies? And first of all, is my analysis correct?
It is. And if you look at, and I talk about this in my book, the very, very systematic disinformation campaign leading up to the war in Iraq, where they were talking about mushroom clouds and they were sure he had weapons of mass destruction, even though the information was there that he didn't, he being Saddam Hussein, and the Center for Public Integrity, which documented 935 lies told by high officials of the Bush administration in the 2 years after 9/11 about these mythical weapons of mass destruction and ties between Saddam and al-Qaeda. And you see now another very, very similar disinformation campaign trying to prepare us from the impending war on Iran, which is part of course, their election strategy. But this is, it's not just illegal, it's outrageous. And what it has done is to lead us into wars, keep us in that war and in that occupation at the loss, a great loss of lives, both American and Iraqi lives, and money, and also our vulnerability to terrorist attacks is actually increased because of that. So,
and our reputation around the world.
A reputation around the world. So this is not just a matter of being illegal or wrong. It's also a matter of national security, and it's very, very alarming that this has been happening, although it's not surprising. You can see that Fox News, of course, is used as a mouthpiece for this, but it also, you can also see it on CNN and MSNBC as well, these well-placed generals and other high military officials and Pentagon officials really planting disinformation in the minds of the public and in the minds of Congress to try to manipulate foreign policy. And you're going to see a lot of this leading up to the election as well.
Right, or leading up to an invasion of Iran. It looks like we now have a second carrier fleet in the Persian Gulf, and it looks like there's a it seems to me, you know, all this talk about $200 oil, I think that's all a euphemism for war with Iran. But that's, you know, we digress. You said that this is not only illegal, it's outrageous. It seems to me like we should reverse the metaphor and say this is not only outrageous and wrong and morally wrong and anti-American and all those things, but it is also illegal, because the illegal part of it is the hook that we can use to stop it, it seems. And yet, Sheldon Rampton suggests that it's going to require congressional action to actually provide some sort of enforcement mechanism. How do we, if we identify this as specific illegal behavior on the part of this administration and this Department of Defense, how do we prosecute the illegality of it?
Well, that's a really good question. And Congress passes laws, and then Bush secretly attaches, not secretly, but quietly attaches signing statements saying, I'm not going to follow the law. But Congress does have a power called contempt. And when people are in contempt of Congress, they can bring people onto the floor of Congress, try them, and convict them and imprison them in the basement of Congress. This is called inherent contempt. And this is what Congress should be doing. We cannot depend upon the Attorney General to enforce any of our laws against this administration, because he was put in there as a puppet of George W. Bush. I'm talking about Michael Mukasey, and he has goose-stepped to the Bush agenda ever since. But Congress and the judiciary, there were three different separate co-equal branches of government put into the Constitution by the Founding Fathers specifically to check and balance each other so that no one would become more equal than others. And Congress has an oversight role here. Congress has the power to make the laws, and the president has the duty under the Constitution to enforce them. And if the president is not doing that, then the other two branches, the legislative and the judiciary branch, need to step in and stop it.
But we're speaking with Professor Marjorie Cohen, president of the National Lawyers Guild, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, and the titles of your books, I'm sorry, I don't have them in my notes here.
Cowboy Republic.
Cowboy Republic, thank you very much. And that's the book that you were referring to
Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law.
Right.
And these also can be challenged in lawsuits, and the National Lawyers Guild, my organization, and many others do mount these types of challenges.
Right.
The problem, and so a court could actually step in, but the problem is that takes time, and I'm hoping under a new administration, hopefully a Democratic administration, there will be some accountability for the crimes that are taking place now.
But let's get back to inherent contempt for just a moment, because you're right that Congress, or at least here I am telling a professor of law that she's right, but I mean I understand, I mean I've read this also, and that Congress has the power to hold somebody in contempt, to arrest them, to bring them to Congress. They actually have a jail cell in the basement, and they can lock them up in it. The problem is that the enforcement mechanism, while the executive branch has an enforcement mechanism called the FBI and the Secret Service, Congress has an enforcement mechanism called the Sergeant at Arms. I mean, they've got this little tiny police force Congress has that is basically limited to Washington, D.C. Here you have Harriet Myers and Karl Rove defying congressional subpoenas. They've already been found in contempt of Congress, and Congress has not sent the Sergeant at Arms down to Texas to arrest them and bring them back. I'm not sure that Texas would even necessarily extradite them to Washington, D.C. Would that be necessary? And, I mean, it seems unlikely that Congress is going to use its inherent contempt powers. They haven't been used since the early part of the 19th century, have they?
No, and since 1934, actually.
1934,
but no, you don't see that. You see Congress initiating a civil suit, but not their inherent contempt.
Right, which is pretty pathetic. It's like, we're going to sue you for money?
And this takes years. The civil suit takes years. So, no, they really need to step up to the plate and put their money where their mouth is.
So is there, to the best of your knowledge, is there any stomach for this anywhere in Congress? Has anybody called for Congress to use their powers of inherent contempt?
You know, I think I've seen one or two people talk about it, but there's just, I mean, you see the Nancy Pelosi taking impeachment off the table, you know, before she even took over, just after.
Yeah.
Don't get me started.
So,
exactly.
So lacking any powerful will by Congress to actually use the powers that they have available to them that haven't been used since 1934. What about Rampton's suggestion that Congress pass legislation right now, even making this more explicitly illegal, pointing out that this is illegal, and again asking the Justice Department to enforce the law?
I think that's a great idea, and rather than appending it to bills, I make it its own bill. Of course, Bush will probably veto it, at least during this Congress, and we'll see what kind of Congress comes in 2009 and what kind of administration comes in. And it's a Democratic administration. We're not going to see all these vetoes.
Yeah, we could call it the Let's Hold the Criminals Actually Accountable for Their Crimes law.
That would be great.
Something like that. Professor Marjorie Cohn, one of the finest lawyers and most knowledgeable constitutional scholars in America, president of the National Lawyers Guild, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, author of Cowboy Republic, her website, Marjorie Cohn, COHN.com. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media. 3 hours a day. 5 days a week.
Well, there's people and more people. What do they know? No. Go to work in the summer. Man, baby, pays the thrills, the bills, the bills that kill.
That's all America, you and me, and all of us together here. Welcome back. Sheldon Rampton, it is a brilliant piece. The Pentagon pundit scandal broke the law. And he points out that the Bush administration's efforts to influence public opinion through the use of these 75 retired military officers who were recruited by Don Rumsfeld and giving talking points to then deliver to you and me via Fox, ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, and CNN. It was a covert operation. This makes it illegal. It was an attempt to mold opinion. This makes it a violation of the law. And it was done through the undisclosed use of third parties. That's a legal phrase that again, explicitly makes what was done a crime. By the way, this New York Times story, which was a big deal, I mean, it was a huge story in the New York Times, and it was picked up by many newspapers around the country, and was reported on by Keith Olbermann on MSNBC. To the best of my knowledge, that's the only place on any of the media, any of the national television media, the people who have been using these guys for the better part of 5-6 years, it's the only place that it's been acknowledged. They haven't said, oh, yeah, well, we were suckered. All these military analysts. You know, why is CNN not reporting this story of how the news was manufactured by the Pentagon and how they were manipulated? Why is ABC and CBS and NBC, why are they not reporting this story? Other than that it makes them look bad, but I mean, this is a major national scandal. And it's not just a scandal, it is a crime. It is a plain old flat-out crime. Okay, so we've got that. And Sheldon Rampton saying, you know, Congress, do something about it. Call Congress.org, points to a page on our website where we've got the 800 numbers for Congress. You can call your member of Congress and say, your member of the House of Representatives, your two senators, and say, I would like an investigation into the manipulation of our media by these 75 retired military officers that was funded and organized by the Rumsfeld Defense Department, by the Bush administration. I'd like to know what the deal is. Moving along, there's a few other things here that have to do with the campaign today that I just found mind-boggling. Today, Karl Rove wrote an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal. This is one of the reasons why, increasingly, I always read the Financial Times first instead of the now Murdoch-owned Wall Street Journal. And when my Wall Street Journal subscription expires, yeah, I'm just going to let it expire. We should get the Financial Times as an advertiser. I'm telling you. Here's Karl Rove's op-ed, and this is so ironic. He says, for example, he's talking about how John McCain needs to humanize himself. He says, for example, in 1991, Cindy McCain was visiting Mother Teresa's orphanage in Bangladesh when a dying orphan was thrust into her hands. The orphanage could not provide the medical care needed to save her life, so Mrs. McCain brought the child home to America with her. She was met at the airport by her husband, that would be John McCain, who asked what this was all about. Mrs. McCain replied that the child desperately needed surgery and years of rehabilitation. I hope she can stay with us, she told her husband. Mr. McCain agreed. Today, that child is their teenage daughter, Bridget. And then Karl Rove says, I was aware of this story. He doesn't add that, by the way, in the 2000 election, he was in charge of an operation, or it is alleged. I mean, it's almost impossible to believe that he didn't put together the operation, because it certainly was happening on behalf of the George W. Bush candidacy in South Carolina, I believe it was. Perhaps it was North Carolina, but I'm pretty sure it was South Carolina, where they were push-polling. They were calling registered Republican voters and saying, if you knew that John McCain had a black child out of wedlock and was raising that child as his daughter, would that cause you to change your vote? And our guests from the KKK in the first hour of the program, holy cow, what are you talking about? Well, you can go look at the picture of his family. And there he is. There's John and Cindy, and there's this rather dark little girl with them. And it caused John McCain to lose that primary to George W. Bush, this is the thing. I mean, McCain had won the, you know, New Hampshire. He was on a roll. So here's Karl Rove, the height of hypocrisy. And Rove, I can't even believe that the Wall Street Journal didn't say something about this. It'll be interesting to see if anybody in the letters to the editor tomorrow points it out. Hillary Clinton seeks edge by focusing on voter insecurities. This is an irony. Hillary Clinton's embrace, Timothy Apple writing in today's Wall Street Journal, Hillary Clinton's embrace of the tiny industrial magnet industry in Indiana plays to the insecurities of blue-collar workers, a successful strategy in other states. They refer to this as her Ohio Valley strategy, where she goes to factories that have been shut down as a result of globalization, as a result of NAFTA, which she supported and her husband pushed through, and says, isn't this a shame? This is a terrible thing. Elect me. I'll fix this. Well, you know, I am hopeful that she's being absolutely genuine in this, and she really and truly has changed her stripes, that she really and truly has changed her opinion on this and is no longer in favor of these insane trade policies. And I'm, I think, respectful of the Obama campaign for not pointing out the hypocrisy of it.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Gonna kick off my shoes and run in bare feet and wear the grass and the dirt and the gravel on me. Going back to the well, gonna visit old friends and feed my soul. Hear the blacks on me.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. So now we have John McCain coming out saying, yeah, let's have a gas tax holiday. Let's throw 300,000 highway workers out of work, or let's attach a bill to our children's future. Let's tax our kids so that for 3 months leading up to the election, we can reduce the cost of gas by, what, a penny or two? Well, actually, I think it's like 14, 17 cents, something like that. As Barack Obama points out, for the average American, it would be about a half a tank of gas through the course of the summer that they would end up with. This is a solution. And then Hillary Clinton comes in and rightly points out that McCain is not funding this thing. So she says, well, you know, let's put a windfall profits tax on the oil companies to pay for a gas tax holiday. The problem is that you do that, you're encouraging more consumption. I mean, if people are being hurt, people who have to drive to work, for example, people who drive for a living are being hurt by the cost of gasoline, then let's figure out ways for them to, A, get more fuel-efficient vehicles, B, have alternative public transportation strategies, and C, perhaps provide some sort of back-end tax credit or tax relief to them that reduces that burden. But to encourage them to buy more gasoline, particularly during the summer when the refineries are running flat out, seems to me like just not such a great idea. Not such a great idea at all. Anyhow, we have a lot of topics this morning, or this afternoon, depending on where you are in the country. And let's just get into it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Karen in Seattle. Hey, Karen, what's up?
I thoroughly enjoyed your show this morning.
Thank you.
And, you know, I've turned off my TV. I view the mainstream media now as basically state-sponsored propaganda.
Yeah, I stopped calling it the mainstream media. I call it the corporate media.
I'm going to go with basically state-sponsored propaganda.
Okay.
And the generals, I think, are a glaring proof of that.
Yeah.
And it made me think of a Herring Göring quote that he made in 1946 during the Nuremberg trials. And he basically said that, the common people, they don't want war, not in Russia, England, or America, or for that matter in Germany. He said that the leaders of the country are the ones who determine the policy, and it's always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it's a democracy, a fascist dictatorship, or a communist dictatorship. And when he was challenged, you know, that the U.S. is basically a democracy, he said, voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. And it works the same in any country.
Yeah.
And I did not think in my lifetime that I would see that quote come to fruition in the United States.
No, but it is, and I agree with you. I don't want to call it one of my favorite quotes, but you know, because that implies that I like or agree with it. But yeah, it's one of the quotes that should haunt all of us Americans. Karen, thank you very much for calling and sharing that with us. Kurt in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Kurt.
Hi there. In regard to the contempt of Congress, is Congress not obligated to prosecute, and are they not aiding and abetting the crime if they fail to prosecute?
They don't have – Congress does not have prosecution capability. That capability has been given to the executive branch. Congress – here's how it works. Congress makes the laws.
The
original, you know, this inherent contempt thing is something that Jefferson came up with, but the sergeant at arms for Congress was to deal with things like, you know, when Matthew Lyon and Roger Griswold, the congressman from Vermont, the congressman from Connecticut in 1798 got into a fist fight and then started using pokers from the fireplaces there in Congress to fight about the Alien Sedition Acts. I mean, that's really what the sergeant at arms is there for. I agree with Marjorie Cohn that Congress does have that, technically has that legal authority and ability and did use it in 1934 once, but it's really for Congress to police its own members. This whole thing with Congressman Jefferson that the executive branch, the FBI, has no right to walk into a congressman's office. There's supposed to be this absolute separation of powers. And so Congress cannot be overseen the legality of Congress by the executive branch. That it has to be done by Congress, and therefore Congress has a small and limited police force, which is really just designed to look out for and look out, you know, for corruption within Congress. And the real law enforcement authority is the executive branch. That's given to the president. The president's job is not to make the laws, it's to execute the laws, to do what Congress says, and to make sure that it happens the way Congress says that it should happen. Congress authorizes the creation of agencies like the FBI, Congress funds them, and Congress defines the laws which they are to follow. The Bush administration is simply refusing to follow them.
If Congress fails to impeach the president, aren't they not aiding and abetting the crimes? And I'm not just talking about propaganda. I'm talking about the war crimes, all of the crimes this administration is guilty of perpetrating. Is Congress not obligated to prosecute or to impeach?
No, they're not. They're not. I mean, you and I can argue that politically and morally they are, but as far as I know, legally, no, they're not. Congress is not the branch of government that is given the legal obligation to enforce the law. That's the executive branch. You know, we can hold our members of Congress responsible for not impeaching, but we have to hold them responsible in the ballot box or by impeaching them individually.
And we can't, okay, so we can't maybe have civil suits against our congressmen for failing
Well, I mean, you may be able to try, but I'm pretty sure that there are legal protections against that kind of thing. That, you know, people can't be held responsible for in Congress personally for laws that they're pushing. Otherwise, there'd be no end to it. The remedy is that, and the founders are very clear about this, and Kurt, you raise a good point. The founders are very clear about this, that the House of Representatives would be elected every 2 years. They are the most answerable to the people. The Senate is every 6 years, and then for the first 100 years of America, they weren't even elected by the people. They weren't even, you know, the Senate wasn't even elected by the people until 1917. So the House of Representatives, which is where all legislation has to originate, which is where all funding has to originate, they're the closest to the people, and that's that check. The check is the ballot box. And that's why it's so important that we not just vote, but get involved in making sure that we have some say in who are the people who we're going to be voting on. If you get involved with your local party, you have some say in who are going to be the candidates. And that's, you know, frankly, in my opinion, that's the direction we have to go. Chris in Santa Rosa. Hey, Chris.
Yeah, hi, Tom. You know, my question is piggybacking right on the back of the gentleman who just called, and that is basically, you know, what good is the Democratic Party? I look at what they've allowed the Republicans to get away with and continue to allow them to get away with. And I really want to ask you, what can we do? I mean, I'm an activist. I write a blog. I've got an email circle. I send out the emails. We all send our letters. We do all this and nothing happens.
This is the exact, Chris, you are asking the exact same question that conservatives were asking in 1964 when Barry Goldwater went down in flames and the Republican Party was re-embracing the Rockefeller essentially wing and Eisenhower wing of the Republican Party. And the question that conservatives asked themselves is, what good is the Republican Party? And the answer was, well, okay, it's this huge machine. It's a multimillion-dollar machine. It has incredible political power. It has great brand recognition. And by the way, unlike trying to take over General Electric or ExxonMobil, you can take it over without a single penny. You just need a lot of people. And so conservatives got active and organized, and they took over the Republican Party. And so, you know, people say to me, aren't you just supporting the Democratic Party? They're do nothing, they're know nothing, whatever. And I'm not blindly supporting the Democratic Party, not at all. What I'm saying is that progressives and activists need to get inside the Democratic Party. We need to stage the same kind of coup that the conservatives did with the Republican Party, take over the Democratic Party, and make it once again the progressive party that it was when Franklin Roosevelt was president, the progressive party that it was when Thomas Jefferson was president, when, you know, who started the Democratic Party. Let's take the Democratic Party back.
How specifically can, you know, you apparently know a great deal more about this than I do, but I'm willing and anxious actually to do that. You know, what can I personally do? What can I personally do to actually start doing that?
Sure. In the last chapter of my book, Screwed, I chronicle three people who did just that here in Portland, in New Mexico, and in Denver, Colorado. And basically what those people did is they started showing up at the meetings. They started getting their friends to come to the meetings. They got enough progressives coming to the meetings that they were able to outvote the old guard, the DLC, or the guys who just thought it was a social club or whatever. And they basically took over their local Democratic Party. And you know, one of them actually was able to help write legislation that ended up being part of the Democratic Party platform plank. I mean, they ended up having tremendous power. Here in Multnomah County, Gavin White, you know, young guy who took took over the Democratic Party here in the county where I live, Portland, the most populous county in the state. The governor, kind of a moderate Democratic governor, good guy, you know, Ted Kulongoski, but he just kind of took for granted that the Multnomah County Democratic Party would endorse him. And so didn't bother to show up. They didn't endorse him. They endorsed, you know, they say, well, we'll look at the guy who's a little more progressive than you. I mean, the establishment was horrified. You know, holy cow, what? We've got a new guard taking over the party here? Yes, that's what we have here in Multnomah County. And that's what's happening in Denver. And that's what's happening down in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. And that's what you can do in Santa Rosa, Chris.
Is there a source of information about how to get involved in local
party? Call your local Democratic Party. They'll tell you. They will welcome you. They will welcome you. They will tell you when the meetings are. You just start showing up, bring your friends in, and show up and take over. I mean, it's really that simple. This is not rocket science. This is an institution that is run by its members. And yeah, there's big money interests and all that kind of thing. But those big money interests are there in as much as they've had their people show up and become members. We need to show up and become members. Let's take over the party. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
A little bit of guitar, a little bit of truck, a little bit of hound dog, and a little bit of luck. A little bit of bacon, a little bit of beans, a little bit of you loving up on me. A little bit of how it's supposed to be. A little bit of life, a little bit
9.5 minutes before the hour. A little bit of car, a little bit of truck. GM has been loaning me some of their cars because we're, you know, they're sponsoring our show and we've been doing these ads for them. And I'm driving a hybrid Chevy Tahoe right now. And back when we lived in Vermont, we had a house that was halfway up the side of a mountain. It was our house, our driveway was a half mile long. And it dead-ended into our house. And we had to have a Land Rover literally to get in and out of the house. I mean, it was just like that. And there was no way around it, particularly with all the snow and everything we had in Vermont. And I'm telling you, if you need a big vehicle that is a hybrid, this thing is so cool. Man, what fun. what fun. Anyhow, Alan Ryder with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com is on the line with us from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates.
I am.
Wow, long-distance phone call. This is a redefining long-distance phone call, Ellen.
Absolutely. But I have lots of news.
Great. So what's going on in the world?
The most interesting thing, I think, is, well, two things, and they're related. Tomorrow is May 1st, and the IraqCampaign.org is planning on unveiling a 50-foot-long replica of the mission accomplished in front of the White House tomorrow.
Oh, really? They really put their foot in it when they rolled that thing out, didn't they?
Exactly. Well, this is also the highest death toll since last September, 47 people. One was just killed this afternoon, I believe, or this morning.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because this has been Meredith McKenzie is with the Secretary of Defense in Mexico. They're trying to keep the issue on Mexico. But there have been two questions, one about the death toll, and there has been actually a general, he wasn't in Mexico, that as spokesperson for the Pentagon, and he said the situation reflects the challenges of military trying the militants trying to reassert themselves. Well, yeah. Meanwhile, when also asked about the fact that there is a second aircraft carrier in the Iran waters, which is, by the way, right next to Dubai, the answer was that they are not ramping up and they have no war plans for Iran.
But this is not like in the past. There have been two occasions in the last year and a half or so that we've talked about on this show where they've brought a second aircraft carrier into the Gulf, and in both cases it was to spell, you know, to give a break to the one that was there so that the one that was there could leave. This is not that, is it?
No, not to – they would have said that, I guess.
This is a force addition.
That's right.
So
why are they adding to their forces? And does this have something to do with why oil is pushing $120 a barrel? Is it that the world is looking at this and they're paying attention to what's actually being said in Washington, D.C., even if the American corporate media is not, and they're saying, these guys are going to attack Iran. They're going to bomb Iran.
Well, I mean, you know, I have asked and asked the Democratic leadership about this, and I am told, no, we really don't believe that there's any plans. But that goes into my next issue, which is today Jay Camboli attended the Senate Constitution, Civil Rights, and Property Rights Subcommittee, and it was Feingold as the chairman, Brownback as the ranking members. They got into some kind of disagreement about the meaning of what a secret law is. But the issue is that this has to do with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court's interpretation, how the Bush administration interprets that, and all of this. And so the issue is that they're not allowing any of this to be heard or come to the light of day. In a very positive note on this, although it's not going to really mean anything, the senators seem to agree that a notification requirement would be a good idea in terms of the president's signing statements where they reflected on a law. But the Republicans on the committee did not believe that the signing statements, because they relate to the executive branch, had to be reported to Congress in a way in terms of asking them, you know, for their permission, et cetera.
Yeah, and I guarantee you, if there is a Democratic president, that all those Republicans will all of a sudden have a change of heart.
Oh, they're going to be so against signing statements.
They're going to try to amend the Constitution to prevent them. I mean, they're going to say, that's it. Oh, man. So, by the way, we talked with Marjorie Cohen at the beginning of this hour, you know, the president of the National Lawyers Guild, about Sheldon Rampton's piece in CommonDreams.org about the illegality of the secret Pentagon program to use David Schuster's phrase, pimping out these 75 retired generals and whatnot to the corporate media, to CNN, MSNBC, ABC, CBS, NBC, and giving them secret briefings and aid and transportation and five-star resorts and all kinds of stuff, and all of it was to be kept highly secret. And basically, you know, she said this is against the law, and as did Sheldon Rampton. But the Bush administration obviously is refusing to enforce the law. They're refusing to enforce congressional subpoenas. They're refusing to enforce even contempt of Congress citations, which is their job to enforce such things. And so she suggested that Sheldon Rampton was right. Congress should be passing legislation to say, hey, wait a minute. No, we really mean it. This is against the law. Any discussion of this at all in Congress, to the best of your knowledge?
Well, I mean, the only way that any of that was discussed was actually at the hearing today, but there's no
legislatively. There's not
happened while this guy is president of the United States.
Yeah,
it's just open and shut. He's got what, 7 months or whatever. He can slow mow it, and min run it, as they say, until he's out of there.
Right, but still, you pass the law even if you know it's going to be vetoed, just to make the statement, don't you?
Yeah, but then you got to get through those 60 votes in the Senate to even get the law passed.
Yeah, there is that. Ellen Radner, talkradionews.com from Dubai. Ellen, thank you very much for the report, the update on what's going on in the world.
I'll keep you informed on what's going on in Iran.
Yeah, hopefully you don't see any missiles flying over the top of your head here soon.
Knock on wood.
Okay, talk to you soon. Thanks.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes there are things you do know that you don't know that you do know, and then there are some times when...
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is the Fireside Theater right? Is it true? Is it possible? Everything we know is wrong about living off the grid? Let's ask Nick Rosen. He runs the website off-grid.net, is the author of the book How to Live Off-Grid. Ever wanted to unplug from the rat race? Hey, Nick.
Hi there.
Glad to have you with us all the way from the UK. How hard it is to live off the grid. In your book and on your website, you mentioned, and this is my purely personal interest, both Sean Taylor, our producer, and her husband Rod, and Louise and I live on houseboats, on floating homes in the various rivers here in Portland. You talk about living off the grid on a houseboat. How do you do that?
Well, you know, a lot of houseboats and are kind of moored and plugged into the mains wherever they happen to be. You know, they bring the power and the water right down to the mooring.
Yeah, that's what we do.
But there's many boats in urban areas which are not plugged in and which get their power from wind turbines or solar panels or generators even, and have their water provided to them by boats that go past. You know, there are boats that kind of sell them diesel and sell them the water.
Or in our case, we live in freshwater rivers. We could presumably purify that river water and drink.
Absolutely. Oh, and or catch the rainwater.
Yeah. Well, interesting. So, how practical is this? In off-grid.net, you have, you know, the best 10 best states in the United States to live in if you're going to live off the grid. You have some examples, a lot of stories in the book, a lot of anecdotes, some of them of people who are, shall we say, startlingly eccentric.
Yeah. But some who are just family people.
That's right. And so what's involved if you want to live off the grid?
Well, it could be just a cabin in the woods, you know. It depends on your reason. A lot of people do it because they can't afford anything else, and they manage to buy themselves a little back lot for $10,000 or $20,000, and then they perhaps just put a trailer on it, or they build themselves a cabin, and for $40,000 or $50,000 they've got themselves a really comfortable home. And I do not mean something grim and Spartan. I'm talking about having all the normal comforts that you would hope for.
Yeah.
Possibly not all on at the same time. I mean, you know, you could have a washing machine, but you just have to turn everything else off to run it.
Yeah.
Or else have, you know, unfeasibly a large number of batteries. But basically what you've got is renewable energy from solar or whatever it might be, and then some batteries, which are getting more and more powerful. There are these fuel cells coming soon.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get your water from the rain or from a spring. And with the wonders of modern technology, you can live just like you are connected to the mains, especially if you use the kind of low-energy, very efficient gadgets like fridges and that kind of thing.
Right. In 1995 or 6, when Louise and I moved from Atlanta, we sold an ad agency in Atlanta and moved to Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
We were looking around for a house, and there were a number of houses that we looked at that were entirely off-grid. And we didn't end up with one, but there were a number of really nice ones. And actually, our best friends who live in Vermont, Hal and Shelley Cohen, are living in a house now that's off the grid. And the thing that was in common among all of those houses that we saw, and I believe Hal and Shelley's house as well, is that they were all built during about a two-year period at the end of the Carter administration, when there were significant tax credits and tax breaks and subsidies from the federal government that made it possible to, and financially practical, to build off-the-grid housing in the United States. To what extent are we coming back to those kind of days? What's the political future for this? How can people lobby for this? What's the status of this around the country here in the United States and elsewhere around the world?
Yeah, those were the early modern days of off-grid living, and it was a kind of combination of idealists and survivalists. But it's come back in a new guise this time, I think partly because of the technology and especially because of the Internet. So now you can be in your off-grid home miles from anywhere and still make a living without, you know, having to grow vegetables.
Right.
And for a lot of people, that's possibly the main attraction. There are lots and lots of grants. They depend on the area, and I won't go into them now. But also, the whole thing has become feasible without grants. It's just become become a somewhat cheaper way of living. Without having, without even considering the environment. And then when you take the environment into account, you've got a kind of moral rationale as well.
Sure.
But just the practical fact, it's just an empirical fact that if you do not have mains power and mains water, you're going to use less of it.
There's
whatever
a,
your persuasion.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a dichotomy, a split here in the United States that I didn't so much see, for example, in Germany where about a third, I think, of all houses now, maybe a quarter of all houses have solar panels on their roofs as a result of this German government program to subsidize this, of saying in the United States, legislatively, particularly at the national level, yes, we're all in favor of alternative power as long as it is centralized and controlled by big business. Let's have wind turbine farms that can produce, 100 million watts of power. Let's have concentrated solar, 50 megawatt, 100 megawatt. But the idea of decentralized power, I wrote a whole piece for Marianne Williams' anthology, Imagine What America Could Be in 50 Years, about the idea of communities, that we should completely recalibrate our thinking and stop talking about even the whole idea of green power and all. Break that up and say we need to talk about local communities becoming self-sufficient. So at the neighborhood, at the level of the 5 houses or the 10 or 20 houses on my block or within my neighborhood, that we are all collectively now self-sufficient.
In control of our own power.
That's right, with regard to power and water and septic and things like that, and just do away with the big utilities. That is a conversation that's not happening in the United States because the big media, the mainstream media in the United States is corporate media, and in many cases they have interlocking boards with these large utility companies. How do we break through that?
I think by just doing it, and we've now got to the point where you can just do it, because unfortunately energy has got sufficiently expensive that even if you're connected to the grid, actually, by next year, the price of solar panels is going to have dropped because there's going to be so many more manufacturing plants, I'm told. So really, within about 12 months, it should be makes economic sense for streets to get together and build large turbines together if they can get the zoning permission and just supplement their grid-connected power with renewable energy.
Right.
And in many cases, sell that back to the grid.
With regard to things like water, you talked about living off the grid, and one of the things you mentioned was collecting rainwater. Here in the Pacific Northwest, our rainwater is, well, actually all across the United States, ours is contaminated with mercury from power plants in China burning coal. In when I lived in Vermont, there's not a single river or lake left in Vermont that doesn't have mercury-contaminated fish in it as a result of the coal-fired power plants in the Midwest. There's a giant, the Earth is just this little marble floating through space. There's a large issue here, a macro issue, within which all these micro issues exist.
Well, you pays your money and you takes your choice, really, because there was those reports just a few weeks ago from Associated Press that the mains water is contaminated with all sorts of nasty, unmentionable things that have passed through the human body and not gone away again.
Particularly pharmaceuticals.
Well, absolutely, sorry, pharmaceuticals of all sorts, medicines.
Yeah.
And it turns out, which is the lesser of those evils.
Right.
And you can filter quite a lot of things away, and certainly for washing and for your garden and for your toilet, there is no problem at all in using rainwater or water from a borehole.
Right, these things called gray water applications. I mean, my wife's grandmother, who, bless her, died, 5 years ago or so at the age of 96, always collected rainwater, drank it, washed her hair with it, everything. I mean, grew up in a farm in Michigan throughout the Great Depression. It was no big deal, but that was before the hyper-industrialization of the world. I mean, in the 1930s, there were only 3 billion people on the planet. There are multiple considerations now.
Well, there are, but, overpopulation, I mean, people sort of seem to be surprised that there's a world food crisis really looming now, and major shortages and rice being rationed, but there's 6 billion people on the planet and growing.
6.7 billion now.
Precisely, and the bowl of rice per day in China is now 2.5 bowls of rice, and quite right, too.
Right.
And so as the least developed countries get wealthy, there is not any food to go around.
So it's even more important that all of us
can be self-sufficient.
Right. So it's even more important that all of us learn how to be self-sufficient and using local energy sources rather than these worldwide sources. Nick Rosen, his website, off-grid.net. His book, How to Live Off-Grid. Ever wanted to unplug from the rat race? Nick, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I was talking on the telephone with Tony Blair. We was looking for intelligence that he would share. I need some information that they can't rebuke. He said Saddam was buying stuff to build a nuke. Well, let's roll. Everybody, let's roll. If I'm gonna play the game and score, well, then I have to launch another war. Well, making lots of money is a lot of fun. We make it by creating wars that can't be won. We'll blame it on Al-Qaeda nearly every day, but we'll never tell the sheep, well, it's the CIA. Well, let's roll. Let's roll.
Yeah, get down, Junior.
Well, gonna play the game and score. And now I have to build another war. Well, there's Romney and Dick Cheney and my daddy, too. We've been planning it for years of what we're gonna do. We gave money to Osama and the Taliban. And then 9/11 started off a master plan. Let's roll.
21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by Teamsters for Change. It's time for a change in Washington. Find out more at Teamster.org. Larry Scott is with us. He is the chief cook and bottle, the founder and editor at VA. I should be more respectful at VAWatchdog.org. Hey, Larry.
Well, what they say? You can say anything, just spell my name correctly.
There you go. Yeah, okay. and most important, spell VAWatchdog.org correctly. And
that's why we do it that way.
There you go. Keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. And you guys, the premier veterans site on the internet, and you guys are just doing an absolutely great job.
Well, thank you.
Keeping up on what's going on. I'm seeing a whole bunch of issues here on your homepage, but I want you to be the filter rather than me. What are the most important things in your mind, veterans issues right now that we need to be talking about?
Right now, what I think we need to look at is the American Psychiatric Association is going to be holding their annual convention here in a couple of days. And they're going
here
to be
being...
Beg your pardon?
Here being where?
In Washington, D.C., I'm sorry.
Okay.
Okay, so the APA, American Psychiatric Association, has in the past year or so put a real emphasis on veterans and military mental health care. As a matter of fact, that's the focus of their convention this year. And just this morning, I don't have it up on the site yet, it'll be up in the next hour or so, the APA has released a brand new study that they just had commissioned, trying to find out about mental health attitudes and mental health needs of not only military members, but military spouses as well. And they found some absolutely astounding things, and I think this is going to be the big talk in the veterans community and the military community for the next few days. 61% of active duty soldiers do not seek mental health care because they say it will have a negative impact on their career.
Whoa.
53% do not seek health care because they think their peers will think less of them. And so what we have is a stigma problem here that the military has not been addressing and not doing well at all. But the statistics get even more frightening, Tom. They found that fully half of all military members and more than half of their spouses say they are not knowledgeable about the warning signs of mental health concerns that could come about during the service.
Yeah.
60% of military members, two-thirds of their spouses, say they know little or nothing at all about effective treatments for mental health concerns that might arise during the service. What this is telling us is the military is not getting out the message. They're supposed to have these so-called outreach programs, not only the Department of Defense, but the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs. And they're supposed to be reaching out not only to our new veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, but our older veterans as well. This is absolutely proof positive that they are not doing this. And what little they're doing is completely ineffective at this point in time. This will all be addressed by the American Psychiatric Association when they meet in Washington here in a few days.
Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org. Larry, to what extent is this, obviously to a certain extent, this is a function of the larger culture, of American culture, and to some extent it's a function of military culture. But I'd like to put it in a historical context. We used to refer to post-traumatic stress disorder in I think it was World War I, as shell shock.
Yeah.
There was another phrase for it during World War II. Was it battle fatigue or something?
You have battle fatigue, yes.
And I mean, post-traumatic stress, and there was another term for it, the Civil War. I forget what it was. Has there been a time in American history where post-traumatic stress disorder and the idea of seeking help and care for war wounds and war injuries, whether they be physical or psychological, was not stigmatized? Or were those used as stigmatizing phrases even back then? I mean, do we need to go back to a time when we acknowledge this, or do we need to invent a brand new time?
Well, we need to invent something new here, Tom, because if you go back and look at in history, those who came back with physical wounds, a loss of an arm, loss of a leg, and so forth, were always somewhat put on a pedestal. Okay, these are our heroes. We can actually see and we can quantify what they lost in service to country. You cannot do that with a mental health issue or with mental illness. It cannot be done. And there is still this kind of spookiness. Oh, he's seeing the mental health.
Well, I think that's where the word shell shock didn't imply mental illness. It implied war wound.
But it with everyone, though, at that time, whether they were shell shocked or battle fatigued, knew that person had an issue and that person wasn't coping well because of what they went through. I think we're headed in the right direction, but we need to rewrite the book. First is awareness, not only awareness among the military and the veteran community, awareness in the civilian population in general. The studies that we're seeing now, the media events, these are all excellent, and we need to be out there to help these people coming back and make sure they get proper treatment, Tom.
Right, and right across the board, we need to destigmatize mental problems, mental illnesses, mental challenge, the whole realm, and have healthcare address mental things the same as they do physical.
That's exactly right.
Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by you, our listeners. This is, I'm talking about get out there, take over the Democratic Party. Get out there and let your radio station know that you're listening to them. Put their bumper sticker on the back of your car. Tell their sponsors that you're listening. If you know of a good sponsor who should be advertising on your local station, tell them, hey, I listen to XYZ. You should be, not literally, but, the local radio station, and you should be advertising there. Why don't you give them a call? And if you get a good lead, call up the radio station and say, hey, I got a possible advertiser here for you I think you'd want to know about. I mean, this is the ultimate in listener-supported radio. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com for our live chat room, and airamerica.com for all things Air America. And stream and all that kind of stuff. We talked about a lot of things here today, starting out with our guest in the Ku Klux Klan going off the grid, Marjorie Cohn, whether or not we can prosecute the Bush administration. A lot of things in the news. Ellen Ratner talking about she's concerned about missiles are going to be soon flying over her head as a second carrier group streams into the Persian Gulf. And she's sitting there in Dubai just watching and looking out in the ocean there to see, where. Wow. A lot to cover. So 866-303-2270, our number. Vince in Petaluma, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Vince, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Great, great show. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
What I've done in my working life, auto truck repair, welding for the last 50 years, owned a Union Oil service station, which was during the 70s, which was one of my more stupid things I've done in my life.
Okay.
Anyway, my subject is oil companies, fuel prices, alternative energy.
Yeah.
This morning on television, I saw where Shell, BP posted huge, huge profits.
Right. Yeah, these two oil companies, just following on the heels of ExxonMobil, showing the largest profit of any corporation in the history of the world going back to the Roman Empire, yeah.
Well, the reason Exxon makes more money than anyone else, they're the major company that moves the oil, carts it back and forth. That's one of the reasons they do. But anyway, my thing is Now, are the oil companies going to really put their money in alternative energy? I don't think so, because that's not in their profit. This morning on television, I received a video on what is called water power. Having been in the welding, repair, prefab business, torches and et cetera, I looked at this video, and it absolutely is astounding. What I read on your webpage, where you don't like emails sent, I would like to be able to send this to you to have you take a look at it.
Yeah, my email address is on our website. I just give you the caveat that I get 500-600 emails a day, and I typically don't have the time to answer, but I do read emails that come to me, so feel free. Yeah, go ahead, Vince, and send it to me. But even better than that, if you really want to get to it, is go to our homepage at tomhartman.com, and on today's message blog, just post it, because I do read those at the end of every day. But yeah, sure, I'd love to see it. In fact, there's a catalog, and I'm forgetting the name of it, but I think it's Home Power is the name of the catalog, or magazine, Home Power magazine. In fact, Louise is nodding her head, that we subscribe to. And there's a company that sells a turbine for people who live in or near rivers that basically looks like an outboard motor. You know, and you just kind of drop it down a couple feet into the water, and it doesn't generate massive amounts of electricity, but, you know, if you live frugally, and I've got to figure out if it's a violation of, you know, state or federal law for me to drop a propeller into the water and pull some power out of the river that I live in. It would be an interesting one. Steve in Fort Lauderdale, you want to get back to our conversation about race?
Yes. Tom Hartman spoke earlier with a gentleman from the Ku Klux Klan.
Yes, that's how we started our show. You're talking to Tom right now. You're on the air, Steve.
Oh, hey, Tom. Sorry, man. You just jumped in there. I was on the speakerphone. The guy phoned you in and asked you about what black people did to white people in order to deserve, I guess, racism.
Yeah, the question that I posed to the guy from the Ku Klux Klan is, what are you afraid of? And this was the question that Ernest, an African-American, had called in Friday with and said, you know, we've worked for you for 400 years, but we didn't attack you like the Japanese did or the Germans did. What are you guys afraid of?
Well, look, I'm a white male. I was raised in South Africa. I'm 39 years old, and I was typically raised to be a racist. It didn't work. Because I'm as liberal as you wouldn't believe. But the thing is that racists in general, and it doesn't really matter whether it's black people, Arab people, Indian people, Pakistani people, you know, it doesn't matter. But how this whole thing comes about, is it starts off very basic. White people look at black people and go, well, we don't want them in our schools because, racists believe that black people are less intelligent. So if you allow them in your school, what's going to happen is your kid is going to have a lesser standard of education because these less intelligent people that racists believe black people are going to cause the education standard to have to be lowered.
So yeah, I know this is the racist mantra, but what's your point, Steve?
And I know it is a racist mantra, but this is how these things come around. You know, that black people want to know, like,
the fact of the matter is, I mean, you know, the reality is, Steve, the reality is that in the United States, the average wealth of the average family that's African American is, I believe, about 7% of the average wealth, that is the assets that are owned, of the average family that's white. And there's a lot of poor, and there's more whites in poverty in the United States than there are African Americans. But when you average it out, that's what it is. And the reason why is because whites in this country have a 400-year history of having a support network, having a training network, having a family network.
Yes,
they've seen their families start businesses. They've seen their families work. They've seen their families figure out how to balance a checkbook. They've seen all that stuff, you know, totally seamlessly integrated with the system as it came over from Europe. And African Americans have been excluded from that for a long time, and they don't have it. Now there is a growing and strong black middle class, but in fact, I lived in Atlanta for 13 years. It's very, very noticeable in Atlanta, and it's starting to break down many of those stereotypes. And for the generations coming up, a lot of those crazy notions, like the one that you just laid out, are being dismissed, or just ridiculed.
No, this you're very right about. Look, I mean, I have a 17-year-old daughter who I believe is part of what I can only describe as the golden generation.
Yeah.
They no longer see the things that we were told to specifically look for.
Right. They don't see they don't see race to a large extent. No, my children had, you know, far more multiracial or friends of other races than frankly I did growing up. It was just, you know, the way that society was and is. I mean, I grew up when I was a little kid. I remember whites only drinking fountains in Michigan. But the point is that this is changing. I think the basis of this, though, when you talk about the origin of it, you know, there's actually a normal and probably arguably at least sociologically healthy instinct to say, this is my family, this is my first priority, and this is my community, this is my first priority, and somebody else who is not part of my family or my community may represent a threat to me, because historically the most efficient and deadly predators on earth were humans, and still are. And so when there's somebody who is visibly different from you, there is a part of all of us, I think, and then, you know, white, black, whatever color, race, whatever you want to call it. When there's somebody who's visibly different, there's a little alarm bell that goes off. Oh, that person is different. And what we have to do as a society, as you know, you have done growing up in the midst of this in South Africa, as I did growing up in segregated, you know, Michigan, what we have to do, and what I hopefully our children are doing now, is say, okay, enough already. You know, we're going to, when we hear that little alarm bell go off in our heads, we're going to say, that is not truth talking to me. That there's something fundamentally wrong with that message, that we are all part of the human race, you know, getting this larger picture. And I think that that's the healthy direction to go. Steve, thanks for your comments. Appreciate it. Eddie in Detroit, Michigan, listening to WDTW. Hey, Eddie, what's up? Eddie. Eddie's not there. Okay, let's go to David in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. You know, I wanted to talk about Reverend Wright's love, but before I did, you were just talking about the whole idea of racism in America. Mm-hmm. The principle that we got founded on was taxation with representation. And, you know, of course, anybody that pays taxes, hypothetically, should be getting some fair and equal justice out of this big pot of money that we just ponied our money.
David, we should get it regardless of whether you pay taxes. As citizens of the United States and as members of the community that we call the United States of America, we're all in this together.
Sure, exactly. United you stand, divided you fall. And that whole idea of racism is usually some scam artists who are trying to deny other people their chance at getting something out of it.
They're doing the exact same thing that Dick Cheney did when he said, if you vote for the Democrats, the terrorists are going to hit us again. They're taking a below the level of consciousness fear, a visceral, you know, a normal human instinct. It's normal to be afraid of other and different, just like it's normal to be traumatized by violence. We were all traumatized by the violence of 9/11. Cheney took that trauma and shoved it in our faces for political purposes.
Yeah.
Racists take that natural instinct of protect family, circle the wagons, and exploit it for the purposes of dividing us.
Yeah, exactly. Now, as to Reverend Wright's love, you know, if you look at that famous quote, Cheney's got this real famous one about, we've got to go to the dark side. You look at it, that came out that morning of September 18th, 2001. Now, if Reverend Wright turned on Meet the Press that morning and saw that America was going to go to the dark side, it's only logical that a reverend who has more authority or more...
David, I'm sorry, we're just playing all flat out of time. Come on, tomorrow, Carrie Lucas, International Women's Forum, Joe Crowley. Don't forget, tag, you're it. Get out there, get active.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, Louise says, that's it. No more hemp milk. Second time in 6 years. I'll cop to that. That's the second time in 6 years I've totally blown a brick. Welcome back. I'm still here. We still have another few minutes. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Debbie, and hey, is it Hazlitt, New Jersey, or Hazlitt?
Hazlitt.
Hey, Debbie, yeah. Welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Anyway,
I wanted to respond to your comment about the Civil War vets and what they call post-traumatic stress disorder then.
Yeah.
It was referred to as soldier's heart or nostalgia. And The soldier's heart actually refers to DaCosta's syndrome, which is a somatoform autonomic dysfunction. So it's like you're sick, but you're not sick.
Right, right.
And basically, I got this from the Google and at Wikipedia.
Right.
And
that's interesting. So it was sort of like psychosomatic illnesses that were the result of trauma was referred to as soldier's heart after the Civil War. Debbie, thank you for that.
Okay.
It's great to hear. Stephen in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for having me on the show. I wanted to comment briefly on your bringing up the racial issue, and I thought you did a wonderful job, as well as Randy Rhodes, and a couple of days ago. Anyway, I think the initial hurdle we must overcome is to correct the synonymous misuse of ethnicity and race. And I think we can probably agree that all people are comprised of many ethnicities, but only one human race, like you said earlier. Don't you think that makes sense?
Yeah, and also I think that we need to acknowledge that there are a variety of cultures and subcultures around the world and start respecting them rather than dissing them. The idea that here's a macro story. The second time I went back to Africa, back to Uganda, it was 1981. I went with Dick Gregory, who was an old friend, and he was on the board of directors of our organization. We were trying to raise money for this relief program. We'd taken over the Namala prison farm, and we were feeding refugees, you know. And we're flying across the Atlantic in the middle of the night and had a few glasses of wine and just totally jazzed, you know, here and telling each other wild stories. And he says, you know what I don't understand? And I'm not even going to try to imitate him. He says, you know what I don't understand? He says, I don't understand why America is always trying to run around the world shoving our way of life down the throats of down people's throats with the barrel of a gun.
Exactly.
He says, when you've got something good, you don't have to force it on people. They will steal it.
Exactly.
And I mean, it's a joke, but it's brilliant. And the essence of it is that we have said, we being the kind of WASP culture, basically the white European culture, we have said, oh yes, we're the great melting pot. You're welcome to come to our country as long as you become just like us. And that is the velvet glove around the iron fist of a dominator culture.
Oh my God. That's incredible. We can still celebrate our ethnic differences and embrace our genetic bond as one human race at the same time.
Yep, absolutely. And I think that what we need to be doing is we need to be saying there are different cultures around the world.
Exactly.
There are different languages around the world, and it's a good thing. We need diversity in culture and language, just like you need biodiversity in a forest for it to survive, just like you need all of the organs in your body, each one to be diversely behaving differently and in balance with all the others. When one decides to rise up and take over, that's called cancer, and that's what our culture is behaving like. Stephen, excellent point, and thank you very much for calling and sharing it. Much appreciated. Bob in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hey, Bob, listening to WHMP. What's up?
Hey, how are you? No, I'm listening online here.
Ah,
hey,
okay.
You know, there's millions of people out here who I can't really relate to a lot of the things you have on your show. Now, just go off in the woods and buy a couple of acres of land to build a cabin. I mean, I need capital to do that. You know, put a houseboat out there and have some windmill feeding the grid.
What's your point, Bob, other than, trying to tell me how to program the show?
I'm sorry?
I said, are you trying to tell me how to program the show, or do you have
a
question or comment?
I'm a listener. I'm a supporter of your show. We live in a classist society here.
Mm-hmm.
People in the lower classes, really, all they do is really work. They're working and trying to survive.
Right.
Some of them have two jobs, three jobs. They live in apartments. They live in squalor. They live in neighborhoods that are broken down. I'm not sure what those people are supposed to do related to what you're proposing today with this this trust fund hippie kind of attitude about going off in the woods and being surviving on your own.
Yeah, Bob, I got it. And your point actually is well taken. There is a certain elitism to, gee, I can afford to go off and live in the woods and be energy independent. And that's what we need to address as a society. That's what Jimmy Carter, and this is my original point, when we moved to Vermont, we were looking at houses, that there were all these houses that were off the grid, and many of them were quite inexpensive, frankly. That were off the grid, that were built during the Carter era. That was back when we were all saying collectively, we're all in this together. This gets back to the point of Michael Moore's saying in his movie Sicko, are we a me society or are we a we society? And if we're a we society, then you're absolutely right. We need to be bringing everybody into this. And it can't just be a hippy-dippy or a yuppie thing. It has to be an everything thing. And that means that we have to involve our government in this. So, and you know, without that, we got nothing. Ty in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Ty, we're just about to wrap up the show. What's up?
Actually, I was hoping to, is this Tom Hartman?
It is, and you're on the air.
Oh, man, this is awesome. I really appreciate it. Hey, I wanted to get to a lot of the issues these guys were getting to just real quick, briefly, with Bush's speech. And I followed that up with a little bit of Rush Limbaugh yesterday and just got me infuriated.
Yeah.
He made quite a few comments in regard to Bush's speech, but...
There are some genuine crazies out there, Ty. I got to tell you, there are some genuine crazies out there, and Limbaugh's one of them. Coming up tomorrow, let's try and do this again right this time. Carrie Lucas with the International Women's Forum about what the world would be like if women ruled it. Joe Crowley is going to be with us saying, don't spend your rebate check yet, and don't forget... Democracy begins. If we're going to be a me society or a we society instead of the me society, it does require all of us to get involved. It does require us to show up and to get active and to get involved. Democracy depends on you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.